Piero. Occhio destro dominante.
Right eye dominant.
Rechtes Auge dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Høyre øye dominant.
Right eye dominant.
Aligne lumna almuhaimina to.
Right eye dominant.
This is the Right Eye Dominant podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. I'm your host, Nick Toro Jr. For today's episode, I'll be talking about the life and the photographic artwork of Saul Leiter. Saul Leiter was a photographer and painter. He was born in 1923 and died in 2013. And if you are familiar with his work at all, I guarantee you that you love Saul Leiter. And if you're not familiar with his work, then I think this episode today should pique your interest to go and check out his entire body of work. And that is not just his photography. He was also a prolific painter as well. What was interesting about Saul Leiter is that he was not exclusively, but he shot a lot of color photographs, especially in the 1950s when color was really not a serious avenue for photographers. Everyone was mostly shooting in black and white. And he shot on the streets of New York City, but his work is very different than the work of, let's say, Robert Frank or Diane Arbus. And it has a subtlety and just a quiet power to it that I really find intoxicating. I found a really great quote about the work of Saul Leiter in Art Forum magazine, which I'd like to share a little bit with you. It says, "As if by a flash of lightning, the work of Leiter, pioneer of color photography, is as astute, avid, and inventive as any of his better-known colleagues, contemporaries, and successors. Leiter's color photographs can be seen at once reticent and ecstatic, playful and contemplative." So I'm excited to talk about Saul and his work today on this episode. And to that end, I reached out to the Saul Leiter Foundation and had a chance to speak with the two people who are responsible for it. Their names are Michael Perillo and Margaret Erb. And they were both really gracious enough to join me for this conversation. And as you'll hear at the beginning, they were actually sitting in Saul Leiter's apartment, former apartment, in the East Village of New York. And it was just a thrill for me to see them in that environment. And it really got me excited for the conversation that ensued. So that's where we're going today. Thanks for joining me. And now my discussion all about Saul Leiter. Well, welcome to the Right Eye Dominant podcast. My guests today, Michael Perillo and Margaret Erb.
Awesome. Thanks for having us, Nick.
It's great to be here with you.
Yeah. Welcome. All the way from, are you currently in Maplewood, New Jersey, or are you in the city right now?
We're in Saul Leiter's former studio in the East Village.
I was wondering because it looked like it, and the listeners won't see what I'm seeing, but it's that already is making me smile. To start off, I was hoping you could both introduce yourself to the audience and just tell a little bit about who you are and how you got involved with this. I know some of the story, but I think just for listeners, just to kind of get us going. So I'll yield the mic to the both of you to start off.
Sure. I can start off. Saul Leiter and I were close friends for 18 years. Actually, I worked with him. In 1995, I got a job as a receptionist at a gallery called Howard Greenberg Gallery, which remains today one of the best photography galleries in the world. And I was answering phones for a couple of years, and Saul was one of the photographers at the gallery. But he wasn't successfully selling at all. He sold maybe two or three prints a year. And in some ways, he was sort of a charity case. He needed money, you know, more than he was able to actually earn money, unfortunately. And in 1996, I became his representative, working with him. And we struck it up. We had a really wonderful friendship. And we wanted to do a book. And when I say we, Saul, me, and also the gallery owner wanted to do a book for Saul, based on his color work. We had two exhibitions, in the 90s for Saul Leiter. One was his color work, and it was very well received and reviewed by the New York Times, when it was up on the walls. But when it was down, this was before the internet was really, actively, you know, promoting his art, and before any books were made, of course, he remained unknown. So we wanted to do a book on his color images from the 1950s, these incredible street work. And we couldn't find a publisher. We eventually found one. That person went out of business. We found another one. That person went bankrupt. No one was really interested in printing color in the 90s. It's hard to believe that the galleries were all showing black and white. So the publishers were not willing to take a risk maybe on Saul. And then fast forward 18 years of trying to have this book made. A publisher named Steidl, very well known still today, great publisher in Germany, published this book called Early Color. And that was Saul's rise to fame. And I was working at the gallery still. And Saul went from really rags to riches to one of the best known photographers from the 20th century working in New York. During the recession in the United States, Saul needed someone to help him manage his archive, and the galleries said, great, if he can pay for part of your salary, let's do it. So I went down and helped Saul organize his archive. And I always say that it was one of the last heroic things that he did. So for 7 years, we organized his archive, and I watched him go through his images and helped him. We became very close in those years. He didn't want to do any estate planning. So after he passed away in 2013, he left everything in my hands. With the help of lawyers and certain judges here in Manhattan, we became a foundation. And in 2015, Michael, my husband, who's sitting next to me, joined us. What would you want to say, Michael, background?
We thought that this would be, perhaps naively thought that this would be something that we could do together. I, of course, knew Saul well, too. He was like a member of our family from his close relationship with Margaret. I mean, I have a background in journalism, and I left the magazine job I had at that time and came to work full time for the Saul Leiter Foundation. And in the almost 9 years since, our primary goal has been to get the database and archive together. So Margaret had begun with a small team, the cataloging work when I arrived, and it continues to this day through the thousands of prints that Saul left behind, along with thousands of slides and negatives and paintings and painted photographs. So in the time since, we've been working on the archive as well as books and exhibitions around the world.
Okay, well, that's thank you. That's great.
A mouthful.
No, but it's helpful. And like I said, I did know a little bit of your history with Saul, but just to kind of get it clear and straight, that's definitely helpful. Before I jump in, you're sitting in what was his apartment, correct? Yeah. Is that I'm assuming that's part of the foundation, or is that property that is part of the foundation? What is the story behind the space itself?
It houses the offices for the foundation. Unfortunately, we can't receive any visitors because it's a co-op in Manhattan. But it also is a storage space for, I would say, about half of his archive. We don't store his entire archive here because it's just a little bit too much of a risk. But most of it is here. We have some storage spaces, and we have a traveling show. And it's about 1,000 square feet. It's an old townhouse. It's the first floor of an old townhouse on 10th Street. And what's incredible about it is it has a giant atelier window in the back of the house and faces the north. So we get this beautiful northern light. Mm. So Saul had long periods in his life where he didn't have any money, but he had this incredible space under which to paint. And he painted in the corner with watercolors. And we can talk more about his painting career, but it was a very important part of Saul later.
Maybe that can lead to sort of my first question. I know that he was born in Pittsburgh, is that correct? And then came to New York City. Based on what I've read about his life story, it seems like he basically came to New York. I'm assuming not much, if any, money in his pocket. And sounds like the sort of the beginning of his story in New York and sort of peppered through his life is one of sort of isolation, poverty, with an intention behind it. Is that fair to say that?
Well, maybe we don't want to over dramatize it. Isolation and poverty is not that far off, but I think it wasn't quite that much that dire for him. He left Pittsburgh because he was fleeing the expectations of his family for Saul to follow in the footsteps of his father, who was a internationally renowned rabbi and Talmudic scholar. And Saul was the second of three sons, also had a younger sister. And of the three boys, Saul had been chosen as the one to succeed his father because Saul was the most like his father. He was the most charismatic and the most brilliant of the three. And he tried to fulfill the destiny that his family had in mind for him, but it really wasn't to be. He had other ideas about how he wanted his life to go, and he was becoming enthralled by art at the time that he was trying to go to rabbinical school. And so by the time he was in his early 20s, he had shown his paintings a little bit in Pittsburgh and in Cleveland, among a few other places. And he was taking photographs, although not quite as seriously as he was painting at that point, but he was doing both already on a daily basis. And he just decided he had had enough, and he fled his family. He would say that, people say I moved to New York to become a painter. Well, no, I moved to New York to get away from my family. And so by that point, he had educated himself in art history and built up a thorough foundation, a really solid foundation, mostly by reading in the University of Pittsburgh library during the summer. He was an autodidact, and those habits he established while young never left him. And so when he got to New York, it's true that he didn't have money. He stayed with an aunt in Brooklyn for a short time before he settled on Perry Street in the West Village. He said he slept in Central Park for a few nights, but he did have friends, and he had girlfriends in those early years in New York. A lot of these people are immortalized in photographs that Saul took of them in the mid to late 40s. But yeah, he was finding his way, but he was kind of on the fringes of a community. He wasn't in complete isolation. Yeah. And then within a few years, he got married as well for a short time. So he had a bit of a social circle, if not a wide one.
Right. So not necessarily like living like a hermit without any outside contact.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. It does seem to me that maybe he was just not stubborn so much as sort of knew what he wanted and didn't want, perhaps. But even like I think it was one of the abstract expressionist painters who said that, you know, if only you were painting big, you could be one of the club. And, you know, he didn't want to do that. Does that kind of mindset, is that pretty standard Saul Leiter thinking to sort of like the trends and artists around him?
Definitely. Yes. You are exactly right about that. He, and he even said so later that perhaps it was because of his family's wanting to control the way his life was going to go that he was determined not to let anyone ever tell him what to do.
Yeah.
And so he was. You're exactly right, Nick, when you say that he knew what he wanted and what he didn't want. Mm-hmm. When we use the word intention, though, he didn't quite have that much of a vision or a direction for how his career would go. He was kind of feeling his way all the time and using osmosis and his instincts to guide him. And of course, he was famously wary of ambition and careerists in mm-hmm. art. And, you know, maybe with a bit of a chip on his shoulder because he wished he could be a little bit more that way for certain creature comforts and lifestyle things. And, but yes, he was not somebody who could be directed very easily. And Margaret, of course, but actually Margaret was maybe the one person who could kind of push him in one direction or another, but even then he might push back sometimes.
Well, I was just going to add that it was Franz Klein that said to Saul, you know, if only you had painted bigger, you could have been one of the boys.
One of the boys.
Right.
Boys.
Yeah. That's the quote that I saw.
Yeah. That's a great quote. Yeah. And, Betty Parsons, who had one of the great galleries in New York, invited Saul to exhibit his paintings at her gallery. And this was the gallery that had, am I right? It had Pollock and some of the greats. But she wanted him to frame his own work. She wanted him to pay for the framing. And so Saul refused. And that was the end of his,
there goes the show.
His painting career.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah,
I get it. I get that. It's interesting. And maybe this is a pivot to the photographic work. It seems to me that, and I just want to preface this by saying that maybe to the larger art world or photo world, and not just collectors, but just, you know, viewers, there is this sort of enigma attached to Saul or somebody in a similar situation who maybe for whatever reason is not as recognized during their lifetime. And then afterwards it's just this, you know, this, and I know people are like, wow, I can't believe this guy was creating all of this work when he was doing it. And not necessarily in obscurity, maybe under the radar to a certain extent. But I look at the work and I know that he also did do some commercial work. It looked like some fashion work. It seems to me that even like I look at his photographic work specifically and know what was going on at the same time by other figures who are probably much more well-known. And to sort of view his work through that sort of comparison, it's interesting to me because there's different, especially photographing in New York, there's this sort of like very specific New York street photography.
Yeah.
And yet his work is not like that at all. And it was happening at the same time. And it's this sort of like after the fact sort of enlightenment to see that. I want to jump into that a little bit and get your thoughts on just even the images he was making feeds to this, what I'm kind of interpreting as this mystique to him. And so the work that he was creating, his sensibility, I know it was informed by his painting, I'm sure. But can we just talk about like how he fits into the sort of the grander sort of thrust of what was happening photographically at that time?
Well, in 1993, there was actually a book called The New York School of Photography, 1936 to 1963, that came out, and it was in connection with an exhibition that was going on at the Corcoran Art Museum in Washington, D.C. In 1993, the galleries and the art museums, you know, for photography anyway, were full of black and white images. It was a black and white world. I think there are about 15 or 16 photographers that were in that book, The New York School. And some of them were have become huge and were huge in the 90s. Robert Frank, Dan Arbus, William Klein, Bruce Davison, famous photographers. And when I started working at the gallery and working with Saul, he was probably the least known of all of them in that book. Why that happened, I think it has a lot to do with that Saul just didn't bring his work forth. But nowadays, looking back on photography, there's a whole another way of understanding what has gone on, because Saul came out with so much more work after that book was published. And specifically, he came out with color work. Mm-hmm. And he didn't do just color work a little bit. I mean, that was his primary focus. Some of the black and white photographers sort of dabbled in it, but Saul did it on a daily basis. And I think that one of the reasons, as you were saying, why his work stands out so different from the other street photographers is it's just so personal and also so painterly, so to the aesthetic point, was Saul. And he was not making any kind of political statement or a social statement or not even a humanitarian statement. It was about the aesthetics. So it's interesting to think what's happened now, 30 years after that book actually was published.
Yeah. And to what you said, I would just add that Saul himself, so a person's creativity is a reflection of that person, right? So Saul was just different in general. He was a unique person who saw the world in a unique way and who thought and expressed himself uniquely. So having known him, it makes sense that his vision of New York, for instance, was so different from that of other photographers who showed a bolder, brasher New York and who maybe themselves were more bold and brash. The obvious example would be somebody like William Klein, whereas Saul was modest and quiet and thoughtful and sort of devilishly humorous. And he really he embraced mystery and he loved to find that in the settings that he walked around the neighborhood observing. It was just so natural for him to do that. And he also had a sort of questioning, it could be this or it could be that kind of view of the world, that also kind of that balance and that weighing of the scales tipping in different directions is also sort of reflected in his work. So just simply would say that his sort of quieter and more mysterious and more slyly humorous New York, not that other photographers haven't captured the humor of New York City, but were a unique expression of his personality.
Yeah. And can I just add that, I think about Saul, so he's out shooting all day long for no purpose, maybe just for personal satisfaction, personal creativity. He has no plan for these photographs. He comes home, he might project them on his walls, but he has no plans. And when he does come home at the end of the day, which makes him different from other photographers, perhaps working at the same time, is he digested his day maybe in a different way. He spent the night painting. When other photographers like William Klein might have been developing his black and white work in his bathtub in his hotel room in New York, Saul was sitting under his lights and painting. So I think his painterly attitude towards what he did, it cannot be underestimated, I think. Yeah.
And that's interesting you say that for a couple of things that just kind of struck me while you both were describing his sort of day-to-day. He's approaching a very vibrant, chaotic urban landscape in a subtle, quiet, personal, painterly way. Not surprised to hear that. Then he finishes the day with painting. Because you see those direct correlations between the photographs and his painting for sure. But also the his composition or the sort of areas of focus versus, through windows or that all to me, it clicks both of those boxes. Yes, a painterly sort of mindset, you know, is clearly at play. But also, like, I could feel the silence in a lot of the photographs. And it's just, to me, it's, you know, there's some irony there, I think, that he's in the you know, the biggest, noisiest city in the world, yet he's, and that maybe that's, you know, part of his artistic achievement is to convey the subtlety and the quieter moments, you know, in that environment. Do you think he was he at odds with the sort of, I mean, he came to New York intentionally. He stayed there his whole life. What was his reaction to New York, and did he love being there? Was it, I mean, I'm just kind of curious if you have any insight on that.
Well, it was certainly home. It really was. He loved especially this neighborhood of the East Village and established a kind of little circuit that he would, you know, there at the time that he moved here, there were tons of bookstores on Fourth Avenue. And
we think that's the reason why he moved into East Village, is because of the bookstores.
He went to the Strand bookstore every day or two. He had his coffee and morning bun at Starbucks, which he called Starbuck. And
makes sense.
Yeah. I'm not exactly sure how to answer that question.
Well,
except that
actually, you know, there, as you're describing it and my familiarity with that area, it is one of the places, at least in Manhattan, that has a neighborhood, more neighborhood like feel to it. It's not, you know, the towering skyscrapers of Midtown or the financial district. It seems like, and also I just know from sort of the history of New York City that area generally, you know, from an ethnic standpoint, it does seem to me, you know, I don't know if that area was predominantly Jewish when he first moved there, but I know that there's definitely that sort of cultural remnants of it as well.
Yep.
So it does make it, maybe answering my own question, to kind of be thinking about that. But also, you know, it seems, even when he was in other places in the city that maybe were more active or more, I say, chaotic, he still, you know, like, he's finding these places to create his photographs that still, to me, feel, it's like, you know, like he walked by and saw this quiet little alcove that he could peer out into the world in a much more sort of delicate way, I guess, than, you know, comparing it to, you know, someone like, you know, like you mentioned the other photographers earlier. And it just, there's so much, you can almost feel the pressure of the streets in their photos. You know, doesn't feel that way with Saul's work.
He photographed locally. I think that was his way of living. And he loved photographing on First Avenue in the East Village. He's been noted as having said that. And when you go to First Avenue near here, the buildings are lower and the light is different. And he liked to shoot there because of the light and because of that reason. But his, you know, his photographs that he took were when he was just walking. He's just walking in his neighborhood. He's not going to Times Square to shoot, you know, people coming out of stores or the tourists. He's just shooting what's outside of his own door.
And I'll say that there are, first of all, there's so many different kinds of images that he left behind, having just by the sheer volume of the archive. But he did go to other neighborhoods, and a lot of those images reflect the same qualities that we're talking about as reflected in his East Village work. So he went to Harlem on assignment for Esquire a couple of times in the late 50s and in 1960. He took hundreds of street photographs up there that we discovered only when exploring the slide archive in the last few years. And those images too, for the most part, reflect that Saul Leiter sensibility of quiet mystery, serenity. and also in Midtown, in his work in Midtown. However, on New Year's Eve, 1952-53, he was in Times Square, and he took a lot of photographs, black and white photographs. And some of these have the other kind of New York. They're a little busier, a little more frenzied, a little louder in various ways, more people in the frames. Yet also, too, Saul still kind of captures quiet moments, a couple kissing amid the festivities. There's one that's an amazing photograph. It's in our new centennial book, among others, of a Christmas tree being burned, perhaps for warmth, maybe on the outskirts of Times Square. So yeah, he did travel around New York more than we realized previously to exploring the archive, but he not surprisingly retained his Saul-ness throughout.
Yeah, right. Yes, exactly. That's a great way to put it. Did he ever travel other far-flung places to shoot?
He did, yes. He did
commercially,
but so he went for Harper's Bazaar to Mexico, to Ireland, to England, and not only for Harper's Bazaar, but for commercial magazine shoots. He went to Europe. He traveled fairly widely, went to France, Spain, Italy. While he was on assignment, he would also shoot for himself. So in the archive, we have a lot of images of his street photographs in other places, which even for us sometimes are a little jarring because we've sort of gotten swept up into thinking of Saul as a New York photographer too, which he is one of the greatest, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's pretty cool to see Saul taking photographs on the winding cobblestone streets in Mexico, for instance. And you see his aesthetic, but the settings look completely different.
Yeah.
So
are you still discovering new work can we talk about like what it's like just to have all of this at your disposal? And I could only imagine, you know, like you're digging through slides and like, oh, he was in, you know, Mexico and whenever it was, and then you're seeing these things for the first time. What's that like for you?
It's pretty thrilling.
It's Kodachrome. If you've ever had any experience with Kodachrome, it hasn't changed one iota since the film was exposed and developed. It's it really is like a slice of time that's perfectly preserved, and when during COVID, when everyone was in lockdown, Michael and I were undertaking this project to go through 10,000 of Saul's maybe 40 or 50,000 slides. So we wanted to catalog 10,000 slides and see where it took us, where we ended up. And it was amazing to, you know, because I just loved and adored Saul as a friend, to see these images that he had taken, you know, when he was my age walking around New York. And then there they were, just they had been sitting there through, you know, winters, cold winters and hot summers in New York, and had survived just to sort of pass on this wonderful information that it has. Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely full of surprises, and the archive is never ending. We, believe it or not, in 10 years, we haven't finished archiving. We still have, a dozen boxes with big orange X's over them that we still have to get to. And we haven't gotten to them because we've been pulled away by doing books and projects and exhibitions and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's still days where, you know, someone will shout from the other room, "Wow, you got to come see this!" You know,
most days, in fact,
yeah. Like today, I found this unusual size print, a black and white of his friends. He had a friend named Richard Poussadart, who was one of the great abstract painters, and Saul photographed his daughter, Richard's daughter. And today I found a 16x20-inch black and white print of it. And I didn't even know that Saul printed that large. I think he had a short experiment with a printer here in New York. And they're absolutely beautiful. How this image of the back of this girl's head just is just there and alive and gorgeous. But
he usually didn't work big, even in photography.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And his paintings too are just, the world has not seen him. He's was such a good painter.
Yeah. So we have, I'm sorry, Nick.
Go ahead.
Well, just to finish, we have more slides to explore. And then we haven't even begun exploring the negatives. So
amazing.
Our recent Unseen book of 76 new color slide images from the archive. We imagine that something similar to that will be possible in a black and white version when we start looking at the negatives.
And time has been on our side because the digital technology is changing every 6 months. So when we get to the negatives, we're going to have the benefit of that technology.
Yeah.
And hopefully we'll be able to go through them quickly. But there's a large amount of black and white negatives sitting in storage.
Yeah, wow. We're seeing all the truth in Saul's statement that the world has seen only the tip of the iceberg, which he said often, but also he mentioned that in an interview in one of the early Steidl books. And is it true. We're finding that there's just so much more to explore.
As a fan and a art lover, photography lover, just knowing that is so exciting to know that
that's great.
Yeah.
And it's one of the best gems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's proving himself to be a very interesting artist to follow because there's still so much more to see.
Yeah, it's such a privilege for us to be able to share these works with everyone. In Japan last summer, we had a projection room with 10 enormous screens and 10 projectors. And on those screens were 250 color images from the Unseen book, but also works that no one had ever seen to date at that point. So things like that excite us so much, and it's a great thrill for us to be able to show them to people who are interested in Saul's work.
So do you have a team of support, like as far like I could imagine the way you described the COVID lockdown project that you were both at your dining room table with light boxes and just kind of imagine that, I'm like, hey, look at this.
Yeah, very homespun,
not far off at all. Yeah, that's what we're doing now.
But like, do you have do you have people who are participating in reviewing work, the scanning, all of that sort of discovery process?
Well, we do a lot of it ourselves, but we have a small and wonderful team leader helping us.
Very small.
Yeah. You know, the gallery's staffs are instrumental in spreading the word about Saul. But we also, with the studio projects, we have a wonderful collaborator named Nicholas Krasnai, who helps us with cataloging slides and prints. And he also contributed mightily to the Unseen book by taking a number of images in and around the studio to help glorify the idea of the slide, which was the real kernel idea behind this Unseen book. Because Saul's cover work was all done with slide film, we realized that in this day and age, slides and the object, both the medium of the slide and the objects themselves, weren't as well known to younger people, especially. We find the slides themselves so beautiful. So it's not just the image that they contain, but the entire object itself is a work of art.
Yeah, the holder, the cardboard,
the mount.
But it was a slow process. The slides were done one by one because there were different kinds of films, different thicknesses of the board that they're held in, because each one had to be focused in on, and some of them were taped back together by Saul. He would take one piece of film out of one folder and put it into another and then seal it back up. So it was all done one by one. There was no scanner that you can just feed the slides, just throw the slides into. It was definitely one by one.
Yeah.
It took four years.
And that whole slide project was started by us in collaboration with a student named Elena Skarka in Germany, who got a grant to work on her dissertation about Saul's color slide work. So she helped spur on the project. She's been a wonderful collaborator. And we've had, we have a fantastic board. The foundation has a great board, and we have helpers like people who work for Saul in Saul's lifetime by the names of Alan Porter, Anders Goldfarb, and Tony Sacola. So yeah, we definitely have a great team. In Japan, the people who have helped us out in Japan, who have put together wonderful projects to ensure Saul's renown in Japan.
It is the two of us working.
Yeah.
First of all, like, I was just imagining that, you know, you could probably, after this call wraps up, and you're going to find something that, you know, no one's seen before, you know, somewhere sitting back there. And just the idea of that, and clearly.
Actually, what I'm planning to do after this is I have about 30 large color prints that need protection. So I have to carefully put them in bags and boards and make sure that
the glamorous.
Yeah, yeah.
I have the glamorous job of archiving.
Right, yeah, right, yeah. Right.
It's not all.
But I enjoyed that too.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so I was familiar with this title book. As far as like this, you know, the selection of work that people are seeing, the things that end up in books, or I even saw there, I was at Perry Photo in November, and there was a great display of work there. Who's making the decisions on like groupings of images or curation of like for books, or, you know, what gets seen when and how? Is that your call, or?
Well, it depends on the project. So, for example, the show that was at Arles this summer, we worked with a curator, a French curator who lives in Madrid, named Anne Moran. And she came here and made the selection from the work that we showed her. So we sort of did the preliminary selection, because the inventory, the archive, is just so large that it would take, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks for a person to go through. So we sort of give we take the first selection and bring it to curators. But the books, the two last books that we did, those were images that we selected. But then, of course, the publishers, Thames and Hudson, they weighed in. So and then the writers for that book called Centennial, they also had some of their images that they wanted included in the book. But largely it's been us. The exhibitions and the galleries, of course, the gallery staff makes that selection. We had an exhibition at Howard Greenberg Gallery in December last year. So it all depends on the project.
Yeah, you probably saw the outer wall in the booth at Parry Photo from our gallery in Antwerp, Gallery 51.
Yeah.
Their outer wall, they had a little facsimile of the stationary misspelling Saul's
the lighter,
name.
Right.
Yeah. Along with the selection of,
which was cool. And then I was like, have I been mispronouncing it the whole time? Kind of like made me like do a double take. But, and that's as far as, you know, like that, you know, selection of, I mean, obviously you're immersed in the archive. You also knew him personally. I always think it's fascinating. Like this sort of like one degree of separation from the art, you know, it's so valuable. The two of you are doing what you're doing, having that personal connection. And I don't like to make the sort of the correlation like the Vivian Meyer kind of thing, but like not like someone like stumbled upon this like who is this and who were they. I mean, you're a direct connection with the artist himself, his story, which I think is just who better to sort of be the, you know, the ambassadors, I guess, of this archive in so many ways. Did you ever anticipate that? I mean, like, here we are, we're having this discussion. Like, could have you ever foreseen that this is where, you know, your life path would have taken you?
Wow.
yeah, probably the 10-year-old Margaret would be very thrilled to be doing what she's doing now. But oh boy, no. Yeah, it's I get a little emotional sometimes because it's just such a thrill. But you know, there are some insecurities that come along the way. Like within about a year or two after Saul's passing, I remember a gallery owner saying, "You can't make posthumous prints. You can't do it." And I believed, yeah, that makes sense. I can't put my hand into Saul's editing because he was a good editor of his own work. And then, of course, I had heard the controversy of Vivian Meyer, the photographer who photographed a lot in New York and whose work was discovered mostly after she died. And the work that we see today is largely edited by another person. Although she's a wonderful photographer, there is someone else's hand in the editing. So I knew that there was controversy, or like Gary Winogrand, whose work was also largely edited after he passed away.
Right.
So I wanted to be very careful with my friend Saul. I didn't. If I was going to venture down that lane, I wanted to make sure that it was right. But when we were finishing the slide project, it was just undeniable that these were Saul Leiter's images. They could be no other person's images, mm-hmm. and that they were as strong and often stronger than some of the work that he had published. I've told this story before, and I told it in the book. But we were working here one day in the studio, and we were, I don't know, at 9,000 slides or something. And Joel Meyerowitz, the photographer, also a fantastic photographer, he came to visit, and he was looking over our shoulders at what we were doing, and he was like, "Are you going to do a book?" And we thought, "Well, we're not so sure, but yeah, we really love these images." And he said,
at that point, it would have been the first book,
yes,
edited by someone other than Saul.
Okay.
With yeah, a selection edited by someone else.
So Joel Meyerowitz said, you know, if not who, then, you know, if not you, then who? And if not now, then when?
Right.
And I realized then that I should do it. And it's been, the response has been terrific. Really, yeah, terrific. And so we came out with 76 never before seen images by Saul Leiter. Yeah. Amazing.
Yeah.
And at that point, we still hadn't decided whether to print any. But eventually we did, for Parry Photo 2022, when the book came out, we presented, I think we chose 10 or 20 that we printed, like that from the book.
And our plan is to always distinguish them in their titles as having been selected from his archive after his passing. We're not going to hide that, you know, at all. Yeah.
Right. And I would imagine that, with so much yet to be shared, and just, I mean, the quality of all the work that I've seen thus far, you know, like you described, sort of like, you know, it's of such high quality. There's clearly, there'll be an ongoing desire, an audience for this work. And I take even like the print collectors out of the equation, but which, you know, I know is a whole other world. I think like there's certain photographers, you know, their body of work, there is no more. There's, you know, like there may be like, you know, undiscovered, you know, like the Diane Arbus, you know, magazine work, or like there's a finite amount. And I think that people kind of like, you know, okay, well then that's all there is. Yet like the whole prospect of there's more, and
yeah,
we're excited to see it.
I've thought a lot about Jimi Hendrix, honestly, because you know, he made so little music that he put out in his lifetime, and then after he died, there have been more posthumous releases probably than official albums, but they don't have the same. They're not finished. They had to be finished later. Some of it is not as good. So with Saul, it just seems to us, and maybe we're not the best people to judge, but then again, maybe we're among the better people to judge. It's just the work is so strong and so exciting. And again, Saul knew that there was more, and he wanted it to be shared, and he said so in his lifetime. So it is such an honor and a thrill for us to know that we can find images that are just as good as the lifetime images. It's
stay tuned.
It's a privilege. Yeah.
Well, it sounds like it's in very good hands. So,
thank you.
Excited to see what awaits viewing. I'm so excited to have this opportunity to chat with both of you, and also just to it's almost like I'm such an enthusiast for photography and a photo history person that it's almost like you discovered a musical artist that, you know, like you're like you found one record in the record store that you didn't even know who this person was, and then you're like, oh my God, there's all this incredible, you know, work. So for his work now being seen and knowing that there's so much more to come, and it's just really wonderful idea. So I'm really happy that you're doing what you're doing.
Thanks so much. Yeah.
Thank you, Nick. Yeah. We appreciate it.
Yeah. We have a little bit of envy for the people who are about to discover Saul for the first time. You know, it's a really, it's like you say, it's wonderful to discover an artist that you didn't know before, and to find that they're prolific and that there's so much for you to feast on. It's exciting.
I think Saul would get a kick out of all of this happening after his death in some ways. You know, I think he would think it was very, very funny that he's, you know, he's gone, but he's still out making new work. You think he's laughing.
Yeah. I mean, he was worried at one point that his archive would be sitting on the curb waiting for the garbage truck to come by. So,
yeah. Right. Which, you know, all things considered, that, you know, there's multiple different endings to this sort of, you know, what's happening with this work. So just that alone, you know, I'm grateful. And I know that there's, you know, I'm sure numerous people who share that sentiment. So, because it could have just as easily been, you know, the dumpster rolls up. We don't know who this guy was. He didn't have, you know, the landlord said empty the space, and then that's it. So, hey, wonderful. Thank you so much for joining me, both of you. This
thank
has been
a conversation.
Good chat, and hope to talk with you again sometime.
So there you go, folks. My conversation with Michael Perillo and Margit Erb, the two people who run the Saul Leiter Foundation. It was really, really great to talk all about the work of this sort of unsung hero of 20th century photography, and to talk to two people who knew Saul quite well. And was just really excited to hear how Margit, in particular, ended up so closely aligned with Saul and his life and his work. And it's really gratifying that all of the archive and all of the yet to be seen work created by Saul Leiter is in such good hands. And so keep a lookout for the work that's already been put out, and there are a few books available, and I will share links for those books. I'll also share a link to the Saul Leiter Foundation. But if you're like me, you're got to be excited just to think about the whole idea of this unseen work that's just, you know, waiting to be revealed to all of us lovers of art and photography. And so that's super exciting as well. So that's it for today's episode, but I do want to remind you that I have a website. It's called righteyedominantpodcast.com. If you go there, you'll find all the episodes for your listening pleasure. Also, an opportunity for you to send me a message, questions or comments. And I have to admit, I was a little backlogged on getting back in touch with people who are reaching out, but I appreciate everyone who has written, and I promise to do a better job of keeping up with my responses. I also have an Instagram account, which is Right Eye Dominant. If you want to see work from this episode or other episodes, I like to share things there. And lastly, of course, if you haven't already, if you would consider leaving me a review or a rating on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on, I would really appreciate it. So that's it for this episode. This has been the Right Eye Dominant Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Toro Jr. And until next time, stay well.
This podcast has been a production of righteyedominant.art. The sounds and music from this episode are courtesy of The Conic Project and Yazar.